Welcome to the NLP View with your host, Donna Blinston. Each week, Donna will explore how the techniques of NLP can help improve your personal and professional life. And now, here's your host, Donna Blinston.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the NLP View. My name is Donna Blinston. On today's show, I'll be joined by Kevin Layer, author of the best-selling book, Positive Drinking, a book that uses NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Programming, and TFT, Thought Field Therapy, to enable individuals to control the alcohol before it controls them. Neuro-Linguistic Programming, NLP, is a study of how individuals store and process information. From a therapeutic point of view, NLP provides a framework for understanding, diagnosing, and gathering information about problems a client might have. Once the structure of a problem is understood, NLP provides multiple tools to change the problem to a series of healthier, safer, and more satisfying options. NLP can be used as an aid to alcohol abstinence. It addresses the real reasons behind why people overdrink, reducing the underlying emotions and the need for alcohol. Thought Field Therapy, TFT, is a fringe psychological treatment developed by Roger Callahan. TFT can heal a myriad of mental and physical ailments through specialized tapping with the fingertips on meridian points on the upper body and hands. Whenever we think of something, we are tuning into a specific thought field held within our energy fields that are coded with information patterns used by the mind and the body to generate the entire emotional experience associated with that thought. By tapping on the correct meridian points in a specific sequence, the perturbations, which are isolatable at the root cause of all negative emotions, can be deactivated, thereby switching off the emotional response. This gives the individual the control back, which has often been taken away by alcohol. So I'd like to welcome to the show Kevin Layer. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, hi there. Hi.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, good to be back. I've not had a drink today, so that's good. That doesn't count.
No. Well, Kevin, firstly, I want to thank you for joining me today on the show. It's an honour to have you on the show. And as a nurse working within the substance misuse world, me and my patients have experienced countless benefits from your work and your book, Positive Drinking. Before we do start, couldn't you tell our audience a bit about yourself and your background?
Really sort of mixed and diverse background, really. Spent a perfectly normal formative childhood, left school at 16 and joined the military. Have a few years in that. Left that and then did a whole bunch of stuff. I went to Hollywood, did some stunt work for a year. I was European karate champion for a couple of years on the run. I then came back to the UK because Hollywood was just far too nuts. And got into designing gymnasiums with a company in South Wales called Power Sport. And then that led me to doing all kinds of work with the Royal Shakespeare Company. And then I went overseas for a couple of years, did some work in Saudi, then came back from there and decided I better get serious and find a proper job. So I got into sales and marketing and developed a very good career and ended up as sales director and acting chief exec general manager of a multi-billion international. Got ill myself in 2000, developed an illness, in fact, got cancer, which wasn't good. And when I came through that, somebody taught me self-hypnosis, and I was massively skeptical, but I found that it did work. So I then went into looking for a hypnosis course, trained in hypnosis, not to become a therapist, just purely out of curiosity. And then by chance at a meeting, an Institute of Directors meeting in London, met Paul McKenna. Paul and I became friends. I then went and did an NLP training, and from there went and learned things like TFT, EMDR, CBT. Yeah, if it's got initials, I've probably trained in it and learned it and certified in it. So I'm a bit of a training junkie. I mean, my latest venture is to sort of look at this thing that Ron Rudin is doing at the moment called Havening. We've been trained up in that in May to go out and deliver that as training. So It's nice to be able to teach things to people as well now, so I can train people as well in lots and lots of modalities. And putting them all together, the NLP, the TFT, the hypnosis, the whole package of pulling out all the toys as and when I need them, really helps to create very effective solutions for clients that come along and see me. And to the point with something like TFT, because it's so systematic and it's basically just almost like typing on the keyboard, right? You know, you're tapping on the body rather than typing on the keyboard to eliminate a virus. That's an interesting metaphor for it. I can work by Skype quite easy. I dealt with a lady in Mozambique the other day who had back pain and a sugar addiction, and it took literally 20 minutes and she's in no pain anymore, and she's got complete control over her sugar addiction now. So it just...
Wow.
I did one in Australia last week, Ema, who had chronic anxiety, and again, 35, 40 minutes, and it's busted, and she's fine now. So to be able to work on a medium like Skype, it's great. It means I'm accessible without a massive sort of travel income, costs, and it's just a very quick and easy way of working with people. So thank you, whoever developed Skype.
It is amazing. I work a lot of clients with Skype. It's opened the doors for so many more people, hasn't it? People who previously felt that they couldn't get to where they needed to get to.
Yeah.
It has provided a resource, really.
Yeah, exactly. Apart from that, I do various other things. I mean, we bought a farm, so I like playing down our farm with our animals now, and actually treating horses is the latest venture that I've got into. People who are either anxious around horses or have got horses with things like claustrophobia, they don't like going into boxes and things, you can use TFT on animals. It's amazing, which kind of indicates at that point that it's not a placebo, because you can't say to an animal, think about something and hope that a placebo effect will have. They have to be in a state of distress. Now when you tap them, they're no longer distressed. It's quite profound to see. It's remarkable.
I look forward to finding out more about that, Kevin.
Definitely.
We started to talk about your book, Positive Shrinking, which is using the TFT and the tapping for people with alcohol problems.
that's drinking. The other one, Positive Shrinking, that was a kind of...
Sorry, drinking.
Yeah, that was the weight control. The Positive Drinking one. Basically, my second book for Hay House is going to be a book called Dying for a Fag. It's all about stopping smoking. But they did some research and they found that people like Waterstones and Smiths wouldn't stock something with that title. So we looked around at alternatives, and I've still got that book kind of in the back of my head. But an obvious one was, you know, that kind of tied in with the shrinking was drinking. So it's not a book to deal with alcoholics. However, saying that and contradicting myself straight away, a lot of people with alcohol, serious alcohol issues, do use it, find it has great effect on them. It was aimed particularly at the people that come home from work and the first thing they do is head to the fridge, pull out a bottle, open it, and then they'll have a glass and then another glass and then another, and then they think, oh well, I'll just have one more. They open another bottle and think, well, I've opened this bottle, I might as well have that too. And it becomes quite insidious at that point because it creeps up and it becomes to the point where you have to have that drink every day. That's when it becomes a problem and you're no longer in control and the drink is controlling you. When I did the research into drink-related issues in the UK, I was astonished at the numbers that came up.
It's scary. Very scary.
As a businessman and as somebody who coaches businesses as well, because I do corporate coaching, there are 17 million days lost every year. And the cost of that to UK employers is between £6 to £7 billion every annum. Now, one particular employer is the NHS, and the total bill for the NHS is £1.9 billion every year. That's a phenomenal amount of money. If you add on the other costs of public, of like police and sort of cleaning up the aftermath, that's another £700 million. So it's not a cheap problem. There are 1.2 million cases of alcohol fueled violence every year, which is outstrips anything, you know, as far as football hooliganism goes or anything like that. It pales those into insignificance. What I found is interesting that 40% of A&E admissions are alcohol related.
Yeah. And you're looking at 1 in 16 admissions.
Yeah. And that goes up to 70% between midnight and 5 a.m. And that's every day. That's not just weekends. It's a horrible number. And the thing is, over 90% of adults in the UK consume alcohol to some degree. And so it affects everybody to some degree.
It does. I mean, as you know, I work within the NHS, and through the last 10 years, and I've seen it become not only a problem, but a bigger and a bigger problem.
Yeah.
And on one side, when we looked at, you know, we had that big change where pubs were open 24/7, and the whole theory was, if you didn't have to cram alcohol between a certain time, there wouldn't be as much binge drinking, yeah. And drinking would be, you know. And on one hand, has the aggressiveness changed? I don't think so.
No, not at all.
It's certainly, I mean, 1 in 16 hospital admissions directly because of alcohol, but 1 in 5 have all got an alcohol background.
Yeah.
And the impact that it's having financially is obscene.
Yeah.
But the beds that are taken up, and you know, these people need medical attention in the same way that anybody else does.
Yeah.
And the unfortunateness around alcohol, from me as a nurse perspective, is it's often seen as because the person drinks, it's their fault. And there's varying moral thoughts around that. But on the same note, you wouldn't prevent somebody who's got a heart problem but has had a fatty diet in the past,
yeah.
from having heart support, you know, cardiac support, or, you know, yeah. you can look at it down every connotation, really, can't
yeah,
you?
Absolutely.
And there is that side with alcohol where it is, well, arguably, I suppose, a mental health problem. A lot of people will start drinking on the one hand to achieve that state of calm or that state of relaxed or to chill out.
Yeah.
Other people will start drinking in a way to, I suppose, dissociate from reality so that they're not having to deal with whatever problems they have got, whether that's around a confidence, their own insecurities or inhibitions. So there's multiple angles from which alcohol plays a part in people's lives, as well as that the reality of just coming home and having a drink when you come home because you've had a stressful day that leads to another couple of glasses.
It seems to be a legal and acceptable form of self-medication.
Yeah.
It's just kind of what it is. People don't want to take pills, so you know they'll take PIMS instead. It's also not the group of people you'd expect. The majority of people that have a rising lack of alcohol control issue now are successful people in their mid-30s to mid-50s, that spectrum range, where they think that because it's behind closed doors, that you know they're not going out to the pub being leery or having fights, but they're sat at home having a bottle a day. That's a lot of units when you total it all up. Another scary number is that over 22,000 people die prematurely each year due to alcohol misuse. That if you want to put that in a different context, that's a jumbo jet full of people every week.
Yeah.
That again is kind of scary. Now the other thing is, you know, children see this as well, and children's radar is up there, and you know, children aren't stupid. 1.3 billion kids, 1.3 million children are affected again by the secondary effects of alcohol, and they have a greater propensity to go on and become alcoholics or alcohol abusers themselves. So it's not just a now problem, it's potentially a generational problem that's just going to exacerbate and get worse and worse and worse. And what's the solution? Well, it's a tough one because if you look at, you know, people say, well, why aren't the government doing something about it? Well, UK citizens spend over $30 billion a year on alcohol, $30 billion. The UK government raises between $7 to $9 billion in taxes from that. That's a lot of tax revenue that, you know, the Chancellor will be very, very hard push to write off. So, you know, it costs, as in crime costs, 7.3 billion. The alcohol costs to the UK economy about 6.4. And there's another 4.7 spent on secondary human and emotional costs of alcohol fuel crime. So the actual cost of alcohol actually outweighs the financial benefit coming in. But it would be a very brave Chancellor of the Exchequer to just go and write off that kind of income revenue.
It's too big a deficit, yeah. for our economy to cope with.
Yeah, it is, absolutely, because you know because you wouldn't be able to plug the gap or recoup the differential in a short period of time, and you will eventually over time, it will, because things will change. It's just too big a leap to take. So there is no immediate fix, or there is no immediate solution. All we can do is give people alternatives, and alternatives that work effectively. Because with the positive shrinking, for example, I have a friend of mine that's a great phrase, and he said it's not what people are eating, it's what's eating them. Yeah. And what they do is, you know, they self-medicate, and food and alcohol seem to be okay. I mean, if people are pushing needles in their arms and injecting heroin to do it, the government may then do something about it. But if you look at the number of deaths through, say, ecstasy tablets compared to alcohol, it's, again, the scale is huge. It's a tiny percentage. And yet, you know, there will be a massive reaction for somebody who dies of, you know, taking an ecstasy tablet, you know, wrong. No, I'm saying it's right. It's still, in my opinion, wrong. So it's about controlling the emotional state rather than having to self-medicate and let the alcohol do that job. Because it's a quick and easy fix.
It is, and it's so accessible.
Yeah.
There's a whole the trend now of drinking at home. It is cheaper to drink at home. So on one hand, before it was in the pubs, so it was not controlled, but it was more prevalent and aware, and it was more of an effort.
Yeah.
Whereas now it's less of an effort, and it's at home. And you know, the government are pushing to make that more expensive, and to trying to make adjustments. And they are raising awareness of how many units and what the safe amount of units are. But even that, even though consciously I'm aware of that, you don't, when you're having a drink, units don't even enter your head.
When you're having a drink, you've had a few, you don't think consciously anymore.
You don't.
So it kind of defeats the whole thing, you know. Education is all well and good. However, and I know this, and I'm not being pious here, or, you know, sitting from any high moral point. Now, I can go for months. When I did Kilimanjaro 18 months ago, I spent about 3 months without touching anything because I was training. I was training for a tough climb. Coming back from that, first thing that we did, we got to have a few beers. And then we had a celebratory session a few weeks later, and I almost forgot the weekend. So, yeah, we can all go and do it, but it's kind of doing it occasionally and sort of randomly rather than as a need. And I always say it's a bit like this. If you can't contemplate coming home and just sitting there and just carrying on with your evening without having a drink, then you're no longer in control. Yeah. And people really don't understand addiction. I mean, I always define addiction, and you see, there's a lot of the blame game given around addictions too. And it's not the addict's fault, in my opinion. Addiction,
no,
I think the best definition of addiction is this. If I was to ask you or your listeners to just sit there now and take in a deep breath and just hold it and hold the breath and hold your breath and hold your breath and hold your breath for as long as you can, and unless there's some sort of, you know, free dives or something in the audience, you're going to last about a minute. And at some point, you're going to have to breathe out. Now, that moment where you have to take in another breath, where you cannot not breathe, that's addiction. That's addictive behavior. The same if I ask you to open your eyes and keep your eyes open and not blink. At some point, you know that you're going to have to blink. Now, that point where you have to blink, you cannot not blink. That's addiction. That's my definition of addiction. So it's not the fault of the person who's the addict. It's a situation that they've got themselves into, an emotional state. And what I'm saying is happening is they are medicating or self-anesthetizing the pain or the anxiety or the trauma or the stress or whatever by distracting themselves. Now, some people will do it by self-harming. Some people will do it by eating crisps, chocolate cake, Chardonnay, croissants, cocaine, cannabis. They all begin with C. Have you noticed that?
I have, yes.
So that's the kind of thing you have to be aware of. It's about control. It's about self-control. The book actually isn't. Oh, it's called Positive Drinking. It's the same process that I use for somebody who comes in with a cocaine or a substance problem. The process is exactly the same, but there isn't a word called addicting, so I couldn't I'm going to use that. So there's positive string. My next book I'm hoping is going to be called Positive Linking, which will be the third of the trio. And that's all about communication and how we communicate with each other and ourselves and looking to develop that. And if you want to get esoteric, how we communicate with the universe and various other things. So it's, that's a labour of love at the moment. And I'm lucky that I don't have a deadline, but that's a problem because I don't have a deadline. It'll probably take years to do it. So that's the third one. But now the book is all about kind of taking control. It's not saying that drinking is bad. There's nothing wrong with drinking. I enjoy a drink every so often. At the moment, over Easter, put a few pounds on. It's okay. I'm only now drinking at the weekend. I'll just have a bottle of wine on Saturday, and that's it. During the week, that's it. I'm off the booze, and I've completely cured myself of my chocolate addiction at the moment, which is nice.
Yeah, I've just about sorted mine.
Yeah.
There is a lot around it. As soon as you tell somebody they can't do something, certainly for me, as soon as anyone tells me I can't, I've got a knee-jerk response of why not, or I can, and I'll show you that I can.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's a reality for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, but I'm a polarity responder. If you say to me you can't park there, my first word is really? Okay, watch this, and I'll park there. If they then tell me it's a disabled space, I'll move. I think a lot of strong-minded people do have that polarity response in them. Like, really, can be used against you, by the way, by people that know your personality traits.
Yes, I've had that one. I must admit. And it is. I see with my patients as soon as there's a theory which does work as regards to. When people come in with an alcohol-related problem that's potentially life-threatening, for 10, 15, up to 20%, that shock response of if you carry on drinking, you will die.
Yeah.
For some people, that's it. That's enough. And they will not touch another drink. Yeah. For others, it's like, okay, I'll go steady, I'll cut it down. And before they know it, it's crept back up again. Mm. And then there's always that few that it's like, well, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die with a drink in my hand.
Yeah.
And I guess it's for where your book fits in when we refer to that it's not for alcoholics, however, people who are weaning themselves off, it's ideal for, because it gives them that, for the people who you can't, but they're like, actually I can.
Yeah.
It's that kind of, okay, if you're going to have your drink, but set your limit of 2 or 3 pints that evening or half a bottle of wine.
Yeah.
And the power of the tapping is phenomenal.
Yeah,
and there is that around that.
That's another thing about it. You can set a limit of seconds. Okay, I'm just going to have 2 glasses of wine, then tap. And then when you actually come to that second glass, you actually can't drink the third.
And it is a hellish, surreal feeling.
Yeah, it is. It's almost like technically I could, but really, no, I just can't. I mean, let me just give you an example of how quickly tapping can work as well. I mean, you were saying there that you've still got a little thing around chocolate, yeah?
Yep.
Okay, just close your eyes a second. Just imagine, anybody listening can play along with this. Just imagine putting some chocolate in your mouth, or if it's crisps or whatever, but for you it's chocolate. So imagine putting some chocolate in your mouth now, feel it sort of going around your mouth, and then just swallow it down. Mm-hmm. Tastes okay, yeah?
It tastes amazing.
Okay, now just do this. Tap on the end of your collarbone. Under your neck, on the end of each collarbone, there's like a lump, like a knuckle. Tap under either one of those, or both if you want, but just tap underneath there. About half a dozen times, and now tap under your eye, either left or right eye, at the top of your cheekbone, and then tap on your collarbone point again. So it's collarbone, eye, collarbone. Very, very simple process. And then stop. Okay, close your eyes again. Imagine putting the chocolate in your mouth. Now try and swallow it.
Oh, my lordy. Oh, no.
How does that feel?
It is awful.
Yeah, yeah. It's bizarre, isn't it? And that's it's literally putting in a new code. And the idea is you could then say, okay, I'm just going to have 3 or 4 pieces of chocolate. Or 3 or 4 pieces of chocolate, and then I'm going to stop. You could eat your 3 or 4 pieces, and then you try and eat the fifth one, and it'd be like, I just can't eat it. I do it all the time. If I'm going out, I will set a limit in my head of, say a couple of pints or whatever, and I can drink that amount, and then at that point, I'm done. And you can use it with food, you can use it with chocolate, you can use it with anything, really. It's a really simple, powerful technique.
I actually, following reading your book, I challenged a friend who was really wanted to go out and very, very skeptical against TFT completely. And I challenged her. She wanted to go out, but she couldn't afford to stay over. So I challenged her that if she did the tapping, went out, and she had her her one drink that I thought she was going to have to drink on the rest of the night, she'd have Coke, and that if she has a second drink, I would travel the hour to go and pick her up.
Yeah.
And I was fully committed to that, and there was not a problem.
Yeah.
And she went out, didn't get a phone call the next morning. She went, oh my God, can I borrow the book?
Yeah.
So, and that was somebody who was adamant that it doesn't work, it can't work, and because she can't logicate it in her mind, because she's very logically processed, she can't logicalise it, that was it, it's not going to happen, can't happen, and go away and annoy somebody else kind of thing.
And it looks mad. I mean, we do have plenty of clinical evidence and data to support it, and Ron, who's doing this stuff with the Haven at the moment, they've just done a 10-year study. And the results being published by the King's College in London. So we are going to have some very, very hard evidence as to why psychosensory therapies do work. And, at that point, then I think that the medical establishment, the governments and other people are going to have to sit up and take some notice.
I think, Kevin, a lot of it is around if it's accepted, it's challenging the way of practice.
Yeah.
And it's everything. It's hypnosis, it's NLP, it's every alternative therapy that's out there that is all proving its benefit and taking over in some aspects the medical profession.
Yeah.
And I know from the hospital, there's a lot for the medics.
Yeah.
Personally, they take their oath to make people better. And if you've got somebody who's having X problem and they can physically give Y, they're physically doing it.
Yeah.
And it's that... it's changing that mentality and changing that step back. So it is. It's a whole thing through history.
Yeah.
It's been challenged. It's been proven. And practice has changed again and again. And it's just people accepting it.
Yeah. Well, I train GPs. And I'm also a member of the College of Medicine. And the College of Medicine, where, it's headed up by somebody like Sir Michael Dixon, OBE, and he's a professor at Peninsula School of Medicine, runs the center in Columpton. Very, very well-known name, Professor David Peters from University of Westminster. They're all looking at what we're doing and kind of going, how are you getting these results? Because we're not. And, with all our knowledge, with all our tools and toys and the economic resources that the hospitals and everything have got, how come we're not getting the same results as some of you, alternative / complementary guys are getting? And we are opening some dialogue and the doors are slowly beginning to open. But you can't do it by going out there sort of saying, oh, it's just pure energy and it's all, it's not. You have to have some grounding behind it. You have to deal with the scientists almost at the scientific level and kind of their language, And then there's some acceptance and they're going, okay, well, we'll start looking at your information and your data now.
It is. It's getting into their model of the world and getting them to accept ours because the other way around isn't going to work.
No, not at all.
Well, Kevin, our half an hour has flown amazingly. Can you tell our audience how they can get in contact with you?
Okay. Best way is my website, which is www.kevinlaye, that's LAYE.co.uk. My email is cameltrain, CAMELTRAIN, cameltrain@AOL.com. As I say, I'm available. I work in Harley Street. I work from home here in Shropshire. But I can also work globally on Skype, or I'm also doing work with the NLP Academy. The NLP Academy with Michael Carroll have been very, very brave and decided to embrace TST and look.
Yay.
And just look at how we can get NLP and TST working together, because they do, as a dual approach to the therapeutic intervention, they work so elegantly together.
They do. Yeah. They do. They are. It's moving forward and it's got to catch up, hasn't it?
Yeah,
really?
Absolutely.
Well, Kevin, a huge thank you for you joining me today on the show, and thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in.
Yeah, thank you for listening, and have a great St. George's Day.
Yes. And if you'd like to learn more about NLP, then tune in each week and also visit my website, www.donnablinston.com, where you can pick up a copy of my best-selling book, Psychobabble, a straightforward, plain English guide to the benefits of NLP. Also visit theorganicview.com and sign up for our newsletter, which will keep you updated with the up-and-coming shows, guests and online workshops. In the next live workshops, we'll discuss how NLP can be used to improve your relationships, both personally and professionally, learning NLP techniques that will enable you to see events and problems from multiple perspectives and to find out what is really important to you in a relationship. Bye-bye.